You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul, Economy, and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. This is Lecture 14 of 16 lectures and a question and answer period after that. Lecture 14, given in Dornach on the 5th of January, 1922. The description of the human organization, with its different bodies or members, which I have given to you, helps to gain knowledge of the entire human being. It is a picture which can be presented from many different viewpoints, and it is just these manifold aspects which enable us to fathom further what lies behind the constitution of man. I have spoken to you about man's astral body as being that member of the human being which, using both spatial and time relationships in its own sovereign way, breaks all bounds of space and time, as it were. I have tried to show you how we can experience something of this quality in our dreams, which emanate to a large extent from the astral body, and which weave together incidents of our lives, separated in time, into one continuous dream picture. One can characterize the astral body for many different aspects, and one of them is based on what happens in the human being during the development of sexual maturity. If one observes the relevant phenomena and their underlying forces, one will arrive at a picture of the astral body because puberty is the time of its birth, the time when it can be freely used by the human being. St. Augustine, the medieval writer, tried to approach the human astral body in yet another way. Here I wish to point out that in his writings, one finds a description of man's invisible members, which is still in agreement with the one given in Anthroposophy. His findings, however, were the outcome of an instinctive clairvoyance, once the common heritage of all mankind, and not the result of a conscious investigation into the spiritual realm, as practiced in Anthroposophy. The way in which St. Augustine describes the astral body becoming independent at puberty is truly characteristic of human life. He says it is due to the fundamental properties of the astral body that the human being is able to become acquainted with everything of a man-made origin which affects human life. If we build a house, make a plow, or invent a spinning machine, we do so by making use of forces which are directly bound to the astral body. It is a fact that the human being learns with his astral body to know everything which is the product of human activities within his surroundings. It is therefore fully consistent with the true knowledge of man if we, as educators, introduce the adolescent to the practical sides of life, which represent the results of human ingenuity. This, however, is a far more complicated process today than in St. Augustine's times, when life was altogether simpler. Only by applying what, during previous lectures, I called soul economy in teaching, can we hope to succeed in planning an education for pupils aged 15 to 20 or even older, which will gradually introduce them to the manifold contrivances surrounding them today. Just think for a moment of how much we fall short of this in our present civilization. You only need to ask yourselves how many people there are who regularly use the telephone, the tramway, or even a steamship without having the faintest idea of how they work. In our civilization, people are almost engulfed by a technology which they do not understand. Those who believe that only our conscious experiences are of real importance will dismiss these remarks as irrelevant. Certainly, it is easy enough to enjoy life consciously if one is satisfied with buying a tram ticket in order to set down at the place of one's choice, or if one receives a telegram without having any idea of how the message ever reached the recipient, without having the slightest notion of what a Morse apparatus is like. The ordinary consciousness is unconcerned about whether it understands the processes or not. And from this point of view, it is arguable enough whether these things matter or not. But if one looks at what is happening in the depths of the unconscious, the picture looks entirely different. Anyone who uses products of modern technology without having any knowledge of how they work or of how they were made is like a person in a prison cell without a window through which he would at least be able to look out into nature, into freedom. Educators ought to be fully aware of this fact. With the adolescent's experience of the differentiation between the sexes, the time is ripe for the understanding of yet other differentiations in modern life. The pupil now needs to be introduced to the practical aspects of life, and this is the reason why, with the approach of puberty, we include crafts such as spinning and weaving in our curriculum. Naturally, such a plan brings many difficulties in its wake, certainly from the timetable point of view. When planning our curriculum, we must also bear in mind the demands of other training centers, such as universities, technical colleges, or other similar institutions, to which our pupils may wish to gain entry. This, in turn, makes it imperative for us to include some subject matter which, in our opinion, is of lesser value for life. It really causes us a great deal of trouble and pain to achieve a balanced curriculum, which is entirely dependent on strict soul economy in teaching. It is a most difficult task, but not an impossible one. It can be achieved if the teacher develops a sense of what is of real importance for life, and if he is capable of getting it across to his pupils in the most economical and in simplified ways, so that eventually they will learn to know what they are doing when using a telephone, a tram, or any other modern invention. We must aim at making our pupils familiar with the ways of our present civilization, so that they can see sense in it. Already, before the age of puberty, the teacher has to prepare his chemistry and physics lessons in such a way that after the onset of puberty, he can build upon what was given and extend it to become the basis for an understanding of the practical spheres of life. Here we must consider yet another point, namely that the pupils are now entering an age when, at least to a certain extent, they need to be grouped according to whether they will follow a more academic or a practical career later on. At the same time, we must never forget that an education based on a true knowledge of man will always strive for balance in teaching, for teaching the whole man. What is needed here is the knowledge of how to achieve this in practice. Naturally, we must equip pupils of a more academic disposition with what they will need for their future schooling. At the same time, in order to retain a proper balance, any specialization, also during later ages, should be compensated by some widening out into otherwise neglected areas. If, on the one hand, we direct the pupils' will impulses more toward the academic side, we must give them also some concrete insights into practical life, so that they will not lose sight of life as a totality. In this way, we are actually fulfilling the demands of the human astral body, which, when it guides conscious will impulses in a certain direction, at the same time feels the need for appropriate counter-impulses. To give a concrete example, it would be quite wrong to quote an extreme case if a statistician were to spend his time making statistics of the consumption of soap in certain districts without having the slightest notion of how soap is manufactured. No one can arrive at a proper understanding of such statistics unless he has, at least, some general knowledge of how soap is made in factories. But life has become so complex that there seems no end to all the things to be considered. Hence the principles of soul economy in teaching has become more important than ever. In fact, it is the only way of dealing with this great educational problem. What makes it even more difficult is the fact that we ourselves are clogged up with clinkers of outworn forms of education administered to us during our own school days, clinkers resulting from educational traditions which are no longer justifiable in our modern times. An ancient Greek would have pulled a long face if the young people of his time, before being sent out into life, had been introduced first to the ways of the Egyptians or Chaldeans, that is, to the ways of a previous civilization. Yet this is what is being done, more or less, in our present grammar schools. And yet it is not possible to talk freely about these matters, because we have to consider how to fit our pupils into the existing forms of our society. Those of our pupils who are likely to follow an academic career should gain at least some experience of practical work involving manual skills. On the other hand, pupils who are likely to take on an apprenticeship for a trade should become acquainted also with the kind of background needed for the more academic types of professions. All this should be part of the general school curriculum. It is not right to send boys and girls straight into the factories to work there alongside grown-up workers. Rather, should the various crafts be introduced at school, so that the young people can use what they have learned there as a kind of model before they find their way into more professional skills. Nor do I see any reason why older pupils should not be given the task of manufacturing certain articles in school workshops to be sold on the open market. Footnote, the Waldorf toys originated in this manner. End of footnote. This has already been achieved in some of our prisons, where prisoners' products are being sold outside. A young person should remain within a school setting for as long as possible, provided that life at school is both constructive and healthy. For it is in keeping with the inner nature of the human being to enter life gradually and not to be flung into it too early and all of a sudden. It is just because the older generation has shown so little understanding of the needs of the younger generation that there exists today such a strong international youth movement, the justification of which is understood least of all by the older people. There are deep reasons for the emergence of this movement, which ought to be not only recognized, but also guided into the right channels. This, however, is only possible if the principles of education, too, are guided into the right channels. One of the main objectives of Waldorf education is to fit the students for life as far as this is possible, so that when a young person reaches the early 20s, when his ego enables him to take his full share in social life, he can develop the right relationship to the world at large. At that time, the young people should be able to feel a certain kinship with their elders, for after all, it was their generation which had provided the wherewithal used by the young generation. The young folk should feel appreciation of and understanding for the achievements of the older generation. Thus, when sitting in a chair, they should not only realize that the chair was made by someone belonging to the generation of their fathers, but they should also know something about how it was made. Naturally, there exists today many a prejudice against the idea of introducing young people to practical life in the way indicated. But I speak about it here from an entirely practical point of view. For it is true to say that of all the past ages in mankind's development, our present materialistic age, in its own way, is the most spiritual one. Perhaps I can explain myself better by telling you something about some theosophists whom I once met and who were striving toward a truly spiritual way of living. And yet, in actual fact, they were real materialists. They spoke of the physical body with its density, the etheric body they visualized as also having a certain density and corporeality, though of a far more rarefied kind. The astral body they described as being infinitely less dense than the etheric body, yet as still retaining a certain density. In this way they talked about all kinds of other mysterious things, believing that they were reaching ever higher and more spiritual spheres, until the substances they were imagining became so thin and attenuated that one didn't know anymore what to make of it at all. All their images bore the stamp of materialism, and consequently never reached the spiritual world at all. Strange to say, the most materialistic outlook I have come across, I witnessed among some members of the Theosophical Society. For instance, after having given a lecture to Theosophists in Paris, I once asked a member of the audience what impression the lecture had made upon him. Then I had to put up with the answer that my lecture had left behind such good vibrations in the room. It really sounded as if it were possible to smell the impressions created by my talk. In this way, everything was gradually reduced to the level of a materialistic interpretation. On the other hand, I like to tell those who are willing to listen to me that I prefer a person holding a materialistic conception of the world, but who, nevertheless, is capable of the spiritual activity of thinking, to a theosophist who, through striving toward the spiritual world, falls back on materialistic images. A materialist is in error, but what he thinks does contain spirit, real spirit. It is spirit in diluted form. It is abstract spirit, but spirit it is, nevertheless. And his way of thinking compels him to enter into life's realities. Therefore, I have found some materialists richer in spirit than those who were anxious to overcome materialism, but who did so in an entirely materialistic manner. It is characteristic of our times that people absorb spirit in such diluted forms that they can no longer recognize it. But the most spiritual activity in our time can be found in technological endeavor. There, everything proceeds out of the spirit, out of the human spirit. It does not require great spiritual accomplishment to put a vase of beautiful flowers on a table, for nature has provided them. But to construct even a most simple machine does indeed require spiritual activity. The spirit plays its part, although it remains unnoticed, because people do not observe themselves in the right way. The spirit remains in a person's subconscious during such an activity, and this human nature finds difficult to bear unless a person has mastered the necessary objectivity. Only by finding our way into practical life do we gradually learn to bear the abstract spirit which we have poured out over our present civilization. I can assure you that once the art of education, based on anthroposophical insight, has gained a firm foothold, it will put into the world people who are far more practical than those who have gone through our more materialistically inclined forms of education. Waldorf education will be imbued with creative spirit, and not with the dreamt-up kind which tempts people to close their eyes to outer reality. To find the spirit without losing firm ground from under one's feet, this is what I should like to call true anthroposophical endeavor. A teacher who wishes to introduce adolescents to the practical sides of life could easily despair over the lack of manual skill, symptomatic of our times. One really has to ask oneself, is there a possibility at all of turning children between their second dentition and puberty into more practical and skillful people? And if, without theorizing, one looks at life as it really is, if one allows oneself to be guided by life itself and not by abstract ideas, then one is led to the answer which lies in bringing children, as much as possible, into close contact with beauty. The more they can be led to an appreciation of what is beautiful, the better will they be prepared, at the time of puberty, to tackle the practical tasks without being harmed for the rest of their lives. Only if, at the right age, the aesthetic appreciation of a painting or a sculpture has been cultivated, can a pupil later on safely gain an understanding of how a tram or a railway engine works. This is a fact the teacher should fully bear in mind. But beauty needs to be seen as part of life and not as something separate, something that is complete in itself. In this respect, our present civilization has yet to learn a great deal, especially so in the field of education. A few examples of the simplest kind may give you a better idea of what is meant by cultivating in the pupils a sense of beauty which is not estranged from daily life. You may have been present when handwork was done, perhaps in the home of a family or at school in a classroom. You may have seen girls sewing patterns onto ribbons, perhaps of the following kind, and there's a diagram. I will keep it as simple as possible and draw it merely for the sake of clarification. If, then, one asks a pupil, quote, "What are you doing there?" close quote, the answer may well be, quote, "We sew this pattern, first round the neck of the dress, then on the waistband, and also round the hem of the dress," close quote. This kind of remark is enough to make one despair, for it shows a total disregard for beauty's fitness for purpose. If one is sensitive to these matters and sees a girl or young lady engaged in sewing the same pattern to the upper, middle, and lower parts of a dress, one can't help feeling that anyone wearing such a dress would appear to have been compressed or telescoped from top to bottom. One must open the pupil's eyes to the necessity of adapting such a pattern according to whether it appears around the neck, the middle, or round the hem. The uppermost ribbon could be varied somewhat like this. There's a diagram, and the bottom one in this way, and another diagram. I keep the patterns as simple as possible, merely for the purpose of clarification. Now, the pupil can safely sew the first pattern round the neck, for its form indicates that the head will tower above it. Pattern 2 can be sewn into the belt, and pattern 3 to the hem, showing that its right place is down below. For there is a difference between the above and the below in the human figure, and this needs to be expressed artistically. I once discovered that pillows had been embroidered in the following way. There's a diagram. Whoever would wish to rest his head upon a pattern with a center that would scratch one's face. It certainly was not designed for putting one's head on it. This pattern does not express in the least the function of the pillow. This is how it should be done. There's a diagram, but now one can use it only if one's face is turned to the left. In order to solve the problem artistically, one needs the same arrangement also on the opposite side. This, however, is not the proper solution either. Fortunately, art enables us to create impressions of something which is not actually there. And so, the pattern ought to create the feeling that the pillow allows the head to assume any position it may wish to choose. These matters lead us right into what I should like to call the reality within the world of appearances, as expressed through the medium of art. Only by entering this reality will a faculty be developed which could be looked upon as the counter-sense of what is merely practical. Only when one's sense of beauty enters the fullness of life can one experience the practical realm in a right and balanced way. Just now it has become fashionable to embellish pompadours with all kinds of ornamentation. Footnote: pompadours were small knitting bags for ladies. They were called after the Marquis de Pompadour, a lady at the court of Louis XV. End of footnote. When I see these knitting bags, I often wonder where to look for the opening. Surely the pattern on the bags ought to indicate their tops and bottoms, and also where to put in the wool. Usually these things are ignored altogether, just as in the case of book covers, where so often a design does not give any indication as to where the pages should be opened. Such designs are chosen at random, often encouraging the beholder to leave the book closed rather than to read it. I gave these examples merely to indicate how a practical sense of beauty can be developed in the young. Only when this has been achieved can we proceed to the next step, which is to fit the young people into the practicalities of life. What is needed is a sense of reality in the child. Again, I will choose only a very simple example to show what I mean. One could draw such a pattern as a diagram. The teacher has to be able to call forth a feeling in the child, and a little practice with pupils who react healthily will soon enable him to do so. That such a pattern is so intolerable because it does not represent a reality. This healthy feeling he should intensify, not by his own suggestions, but by drawing it out of the pupils, to the extent that they will feel, if I see such a pattern, it is as if I were seeing a person with only a left half of a face, or only one left arm or foot. Such a thing goes against the grain, because it does not represent a reality. This is the kind of reaction the teacher should induce in the pupil, for it is all part of an aesthetic sense. In short, he should allow the pupils to feel that they cannot rest until they have completed the pattern by drawing the missing complementary part. In this way, one cultivates in the children an immediate and living sense of beauty. The word schön, beautiful, is related to the word shine, shine, luster, glory. Such an approach stimulates the child's astral body to become flexible and mobile, and so to function well as a living member of the human being. It is important for the teacher to cultivate an aesthetic sense also in himself. He will soon see how this enlivens his children. Then he will also nurture an artistic approach to the other activities which I have already mentioned during the course of these lectures. I then pointed out that everything a teacher brings to the child when it enters class one should be permeated by an artistic element. Also, when talking to the children about their surroundings, the teacher should do so with real artistry, as otherwise he might easily slip into what is called anthropomorphism, into restricting everything to narrow human interests. For instance, when clothing his content in fairy tales or legends, he may be misled into telling his class that certain kinds of trees spring up from the ground so that from the bark people can make corks with which to seal their bottles. The pictorial approach must never be coached in such terms. The pictures a teacher uses at this particular age must be created out of a sense of beauty. And beauty demands truth and clarity, which directly speaks to human feeling. Beauty in nature does not need any anthropomorphism. If we encourage a sense of beauty for everything the pre-puberty pupil meets, he will, from puberty onward, bring human qualities also into the practical life he is now entering, harmonizing his way of looking at the world with the practical tasks awaiting him. All this has an important bearing upon the social question, which needs to be tackled from many different angles. Few people are aware of this today. It is absolutely possible that all the ugliness which surrounds us in practically every European city, and you can hardly deny that from an aesthetic point of view we find ourselves surrounded, at least to a large extent, by atrocities of all kinds in almost every large city, that all this ugliness would gradually be transmuted if we could cultivate, for a few generations, the sense of beauty which lives unspoiled in every child. Today we look at man from the outside, and we see his physical body. We observe also the inner man from the point of view of his personality, his ego. Between the ego and the physical body there live the astral and the etheric bodies. These latter two members are becoming more and more stunted in our times. On the whole, they are developed properly only in Oriental peoples. In the Western peoples they are atrophying. In the West they cannot develop properly. However, by awakening an all-comprehensive feeling for beauty, we can nurture their free development. And during the school years, the growing human being is most receptive for the appreciation of what is beautiful. We ought, therefore, to do everything possible to awaken and cultivate the sense of beauty, especially during the time between the second dentition and the coming of puberty. In this way, it will live on into later life. This is of special importance also with regard to the element of speech. Languages are the outcome of a direct human response to inner experiences. If one is able to immerse oneself in the quality of spoken sounds, one can still hear in them the important part which such inner responses have played in the formation of certain words. But in our abstract life, when the logical content of language plays the leading part, this perception of the artistic element almost has been lost. True, there is an inherent logic in language, but this represents only its skeleton, something which is dead. There is much else besides logic in language. Its breath and pulse can be felt only by those who have been touched by the creative genius of language itself. From this point of view, try to feel how words want to project themselves into outer life. I will give a characteristic example, hoping that you will understand it, although it is chosen from the German language. If you take the German word Sucht, sickness, you can detect in it the word Suchen, to seek. The body has a Sucht, a sickness. It is seeking for something which under normal conditions it would not do. Certain additional words then point to what the body is seeking. For example, Gelbsucht, jaundice, yellow sickness, or Fallsucht, epilepsy, falling sickness. The word Sucht, sickness, enables the human soul to experience what the body is seeking through certain forms of sickness. The further west we go, the more we find that people have lost this ability of appreciating the artistic element in language, which the Oriental is still able to experience. It is of great importance for us to regain at least some fundamental experience of the living genius of language. This will be of special benefit for greater international understanding within the social sphere. You must forgive me if I choose another example, near and dear to me, in order to explain what I mean, but I must ask you to be very careful not to misunderstand what I am about to say. You see, in page 88, in the English translation of my book, German title, Die Kernpunkte der sozialen Frage, translated as the Threefold Commonwealth, also footnote called Toward Social Renewal, end of footnote, I find the following sentence, quote, "The freedom of one cannot prosper without the freedom of all," close quote. This sentence, when weighed up by a deep-seated feeling for words, is nonsense. As mentioned just now, you must not misunderstand me, but this English sentence simply makes no sense, for it expresses something quite different from the original German words, which read, quote, "Die Freiheit des einen kann nicht ohne die Freiheit des anderen gedeihen," close quote. This sentence really wants to say something altogether different. In order to convey its meaning correctly, the translator would have to circumscribe it completely. The translation of any book ought to read as if it had been written directly out of the genius of the new language. Anything else is not really acceptable. I know for certain that Bentham's hair would stand on end if in the astral world he were to come across the sentence, quote, "The freedom of one cannot prosper without the freedom of all," close quote. This sentence simply does not stand a test of clear thinking, and this for a special reason. If you came across such a sentence in a book, your immediate response would be, especially if you related it to education, "Yes, there is such a thing as freedom, but the author talks about a situation which does not apply in England." In the original German language, however, this is not the case. There its content does make sense, but if translated in the way quoted, the real meaning conveyed by the original version cannot be understood. And what are the reasons? I will show you them by focusing on the significant word in the sentence. In English, the word is freedom. If one were to match the quality of this word with the corresponding German word, one would have to choose Freitum. The ending dom, D-O-M, in English corresponds to the ending tum in German. If such a word existed in the German language, one could use freedom with impunity. Freitum would then be translated with freedom, and there would be no misunderstanding. But the word used in the original text is Freiheit. The ending Heit corresponds to the English ending Hood. In order to show you that the translation of Freiheit into freedom is not in harmony with the genius of language, I have to quote yet another German word, which is Irrtum, error. This word expresses a definite fact, something which happens once only. If one wanted to give this word the ending Heit, one would have to form the word Irreheit. Although you won't find this word in a German dictionary, you would not go against the genius of the language if you were to coin it. It would be quite possible to use it. Irreheit immediately leads us into the inner being of man. It expresses a quality of man's inner nature. There are no words in the German language ending with Heit which do not point to something which is mobile within a person. Such words carry their meaning toward a person. Actually, it is a pity that we do not use the word Freitum in German, for if it existed, we could directly express the meaning of the English word freedom without having to circumscribe it. This kind of thing leads us right into the depths of language itself. It makes one aware of the genius of language. Therefore, when I write a book in German, I try to choose words which can be translated correctly into other languages. My German readers promptly call it a bad style. But this is not always possible. If, for instance, a book is addressed to the cultural life in Germany, it may be necessary at times to consider the German situation first of all. And this is why I have repeatedly used the word Freiheit, which, however, should never be translated as freedom. My book, titled Die Philosophie der Freiheit, should never bear the English title The Philosophy of Freedom. The right title for this book in English has yet to be found. It is quite interesting to look at these things also from a statistical point of view. In doing so, I am neither being pedantic nor unscrupulous, but my findings are the result of deliberate investigation. If I were to write a book about education in German, the word Freiheit would appear time and time again in certain of its chapters. To find out whether the corresponding word, freedom, would be used also in an English book on education, I carefully looked through the likely chapters of such a book, and lo and behold, the word freedom did not appear at all, not even a single time. This is the sort of thing for which one ought to develop a fine perception, for it is the very stuff we need for greater international understanding. It ought to be taken into account already during the school years. I am certainly keenly aware of it when writing books, as already mentioned. Consequently, I am very cautious in the choice of certain words. If, for example, I use the German word Natur in one or another of my sentences, I can be quite sure that it will be rendered as nature in an English translation. There is no doubt at all that Natur would be translated as nature. And yet the English word nature would awaken quite a different conception from that of the German word Natur. This is the reason why, in anticipation of future translations, I have paraphrased certain words in some of my writings. I have done so in order to avoid a wrong interpretation of what I wished to say. There are, of course, many occasions when I did use the word Natur, but when it was important to match the German concept with a foreign one, I paraphrased Natur with, quote, the world of sense, close quote, German die sinnliche Welt, especially if the book was likely to be translated into Western languages. To me, quote, the world of sense, close quote, seems to match, more or less, the concept of Natur as used in the German language. Obviously, I expected sinnliche Welt to be rendered as nature in an English translation, only to find that once again it had been translated literally into the world of sense. It really is of great importance to become aware of the living genius of language, especially where an artistic treatment of language is concerned. Apart from the fact that in the translation of the sentence quoted, the genius of language had not been recognized. I only mention this in passing. You also find there the following wording, quote, "The freedom of one cannot prosper without the freedom of all," close quote. This again makes no sense in German. It was neither written nor implied. What the original sentence says is, quote, "The freedom of one cannot prosper without the freedom of the other, of his brother or of his neighbor," and this is the real point. I must ask you again not to misunderstand my intentions. I choose this example near and dear to me to show how we have reached a stage in human development where instead of experiencing the realities of life, we tend to skim them over, and language offered a particularly striking example for showing it. Gradually, our civilization has made us rather slovenly. We must make the effort to live ourselves into the language again, to live again with its words. Only then will we be able to bring to fruition the request I have made earlier on, that the child, having been introduced first to grammar, then to the rhetorical aspect of language, that is, to its beauty, should eventually also be brought to an appreciation of the artistic element of language. We must open the pupil's eyes and hearts to the artistic element living in language. This is important also in fostering a greater feeling of brotherhood with other nations. And it is equally important to recognize that what is generally referred to as the social question often has to be looked upon from quite new and different angles. The end of Lecture 14.